At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Hey, everybody. It's Devin.
And Kate.
Welcome to Part 2 Med Crimes.
Part 2, baby.
Part 2.
Actually,
guys,
oh, happy November. Guess where me and Devin just came from? We went Christmas shopping. My God, I've spent more money than I should have, but you
I
know
think
what?
We did pretty good.
You know what? Sometimes you just
we
have
did not
to
follow
buy
the rules of the game, though.
No, we did not.
Where if you did not guess the correct price and you won't buy it, we still bought it.
Sometimes I just bought it anyway.
We said, well, we were only off by a dollar, so
yeah.
It's fine.
I mean, if it was only like a dollar, I felt like I could just give myself, you know what?
That
life
was
is too short.
That was preseason.
Sometimes you really do just like physically on a chemical level need the cookie jar that is shaped like a little red truck with a Christmas tree in the back.
Or the gingerbread house.
Or the gingerbread house. One of the two. Absolutely.
I did get the gingerbread house.
Yes,
I'm
you
doing
did.
My kitchen in gingerbread this year.
Which,
and I've never done
wait.
That before.
You also just redid your kitchen. So like.
Which is, yeah, I mean, part of my kitchen for
yeah.
sure. So it needed its own little thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's gingerbread.
Yay!
I've never really bought a lot of gingerbread decorations before.
I love gingerbread decorations.
I think what I got is probably the first set
I'm sure you're
of
right.
things. Yeah. But yes, also what you were just saying about being a mom has wanted to make us like extra special decorate because you never used to be a big decorator.
No, I never decorated.
You were very minimal.
I actually like wasn't a big Christmas person in general.
You would do a tree
mm-hmm.
and that was really about it.
That was it.
And even like when your kids were like 1 and 2.
Yeah, I
like,
never.
You still.
Never was into it.
It was only until like the last like 3 years, maybe.
Yeah.
Three or four years.
Like the kids yeah. just.
Like you started to do a little bit more.
Yeah. It's just Christmas then, in general is so much more magical, like with the kids.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That, you know, just creating all of that is just like it makes
Isn't
it so much more enjoyable. You know what I mean?
So Santa came to my house.
Yep.
On Saturday morning. I had to think what night it was. Saturday morning. As he does,
mm-hmm.
he always comes the night after trick-or-treating and gives my kids a letter, just basically mm-hmm. letting them know that that season is almost here.
Yeah.
So here's your reminder to be good, kind,
oh,
respectful
nice.
Little boys and to love each other because
really
I'm
good
watching.
Idea.
And they're getting out of the age of timeouts now, but mm-hmm. Santa visits and stays for the Christmas season at the bottom of our stairs.
Mm-hmm.
And our timeout location used to be at the bottom of the stairs. I mean, it is still there if they need it, but they're getting much older. They're phasing out. They don't, you know, but they hated sitting on the stairs
oh,
in front
no.
of Santa.
Yes,
they
I'm
would
sure.
not want to sit there and have that man see
have that
them
man. That
and
man.
Know that they had to go to time out.
Yep.
Oh, it was so good.
Oh, my God. We're
so behaved November and December.
I know, right? I know.
It's my
oh,
annual
God.
Threat to them.
Oh,
but
God.
Yes, I also saw something that just said, men, carry the totes. Bring them up from the basement or down from the garage in our case. Just do it. Don't laugh at your wives.
No.
Or just, we are making the season extra special
just
and that's
us,
part of our job.
Let us create some magic.
I think I saw that, you know, just on the...
I think I saw that on the interwebs.
The socials.
Yes.
Yes.
Upon the interwebs and socials.
Yes.
Absolutely.
One day, your Christmas, your children will look back and realize that Christmas was all because of mom.
That's right. Yes. Some dad, mostly mom, though. Let's
yeah,
be honest,
oh, yeah. I
for
mean,
sure.
There's some dads out there that are like, whew.
100%.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
I mean, my husband loves Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
But he does not like that I like to decorate before Thanksgiving.
That's a hard line for him.
He, like, Friday after, like, I'm sure he'd happily do every tote that I asked him.
Mm-hmm.
He would decorate from, like, 5 a.m. to midnight.
Mm-hmm. After Thanksgiving.
After Thanksgiving.
But before Thanksgiving, that's where we draw the
My
line.
Husband actually, we will move on, but one last little thing. My husband actually last year at the tree farm got into a thing with another person.
I remember this.
They were going to go after the tree that we had already chosen.
I forgot all about that. That's
there was
amazing.
Like an altercation because
yes.
some woman was about to like, hey, honey, about this one. And my husband's like, no, I'm sorry. My family, like, they just went over there, but I'm kind of here. We're like, mm-hmm. we're going to have this tree. And she was like, finders keepers, man. And my husband's like, I'm literally standing right here.
I'm the finder of the tree. I found it
first.
And
I don't think there has been a time where I have loved that man more.
Hell
like,
yeah.
You got that tree for your family.
Protect this house.
You chopped it down. I heard her bitching all the way across the tree farm. And I was like, yeah, David.
That's right.
You go.
That's right. And you guys got that tree.
So.
Amazing.
Speaking of awesomeness and loving and whatnot, we have Patreon.
We sure do. And Heather Cox.
Hey.
Heather Cox. Guess what?
She is?
Jack Frost.
Yeah, you are.
Jack Frost, because you're bringing with you the beautiful cold weather, the holiday season, the joy, the happiness.
You're nibbling at the noses.
You are. And you know what? I realize I'm fully aware that Thanksgiving hasn't happened yet. Okay. Relax.
But it's also we live in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And we've had frost.
Oh, yeah. So she's Jack Frost.
Yeah.
That's what's happening.
He visits early.
Heather Cox, thank you for visiting early.
Thank you.
Thank you for being Jack Frost.
Yes.
We love the crap out of you.
So before we dive into part two, our season four is wrapping up.
It sure is, guys. So get us our last minute submissions for Break Room Banter because it is coming, baby.
We'll recap it again at the end of the episode, but we have two more episodes after today.
We sure do.
Of season four. Mm-hmm. And then we are wrapping it up until January.
Yep. So if you want us to maybe read us one of your crazy, kooky, spooky, funny, hilarious stories on the air, please let us know. We'd love to read it.
Yes, for sure.
So
pot duh.
Just to recap a little bit, if you haven't listened to part one, please go back and listen. We're talking about Dr. Anthony Pignataro, and if you can call him a doctor, really, which is like very questionable. He was born into privilege and continued to insist everything be handed to him in adulthood as well, including his privileges to practice medicine. And after piecemealing school and leaving multiple residency programs unfinished, he somehow squirreled his way some hospital privileges. And then ended up, you know, sort of coining this detachable, implantable toupee situation. It was kind of comical,
but it took off, though.
And it put him on the map. And then he started marketing himself as this, like, you know, world-renowned plastic surgeon, started finally finding some success in his private practice. But he kept having these bad outcomes. And there was even this one poor lady who went in for a routine liposuction session, which took place in his surgery center, which was like this basement, totally mutilated. He perforated her peritoneum, gave her like raging infection and almost killed her. And then he like went and found her at the hospital and reamed her out.
And she had no idea like how, because she never called him. Like she did once and he was like,
it's fine. And he was like, everything's
normal. But she never contacted him to say, hey, I'm in the hospital.
No, it's wild that it went that way. Right. And that he found her and yelled at her about it.
At 2 in the morning.
At 2 o'clock in the morning in the hospital.
That's outrageous.
I cannot even believe that happened. Like, it sounds made up. It sounds like a totally made up situation.
You were not wrong when you called this juicy.
Oh, I'm telling you. Like, it gets even crazy.
Do we need a
crazy
juicer?
Oh, yeah. We need to get the juicer out. Like, get the ninja out
we're
right
squeezing
now.
It.
We're Devin's squeezing it. She's making some juice. So, it is now summer of 1997. Anthony's practice is thriving. He's buying expensive cars. His wife and his two kids, they live in the, I believe, West Seneca area, right? Is what I had said?
Yes.
And they are living in a very privileged, you know, life as well because he's been very successful.
At least his wife is finally able to, like, reap because she's been married to this douchebag for a while.
And
so
she's been just following his ass left and right.
Dealing with his infidelity case and whatnot.
Yes.
And, like, fine. So she deserves it.
Absolutely. And he's like, you know, he kind of just like berates her, treats her, you know, kind of shittily. So, you know what? If she, you know, has a minute where she has some enjoyment, then good for her. There was one thing about like Anthony's practice. So I didn't go much into like the structure of the practice itself. So a lot of the reason he was so financially successful is that he cut a lot of corners, like in terms of having the right things, the right staff, the right people in his practice. So I had said that he had this like basement area surgery center. He did not staff an anesthesia provider or an anesthesiologist whatsoever. He did not staff any trained surgery staff whatsoever. In fact, he had the only other medical person in his practice that worked for him was a licensed practical nurse who assisted him with the procedures. He also employed his wife, who is not a medical person. She had before worked only a clerical role at a, I believe, some sort of outpatient surgery center. And he also employed...
What was she doing? What was the wife doing?
Literally like front desk stuff and helping with some procedures and some medical stuff, like totally untrained. And then he also had a 17-year-old high school student who was interested in becoming a doctor who he, quote unquote, employed as an intern. And this was his staff.
You should have at least had like a med student as your intern and not like a high school kid.
I mean,
let them go to college and then.
Sure.
Depending on what type of
intern. If you're having them do work.
I mean, it depends on what the internship was.
And we go a little bit more into like what they were asked to do, like specifically. But it's the fact that this was these were the only other people working in his practice.
So one nurse, a wife, and a high school kid. A minor.
Exactly. And he kept it this way to create zero overhead, right?
So I'm sure he wasn't paying the wife. It was just do this work.
It was just do this work.
Back to us.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So the most alarming thing possibly is the lack, I mean, aside from the lack of sterilization.
Yeah, like, it was in a basement. It was in
in a literal basement that kind of looked like this. And the shocking thing is he is administering anesthesia and conscious sedations to patients. Right. He's doing that without an anesthesia provider present. So he is essentially practicing an entire different specialty of for which he has no knowledge
while
or practice.
While he's supposed to be the surgeon.
While he's supposed to be doing a procedure.
So he's supposed to monitor their respiratory status while also.
So that's the thing. It's its own specialty. Right. And people and surgeons and proceduralists staff an anesthesia provider because the hemodynamics, the airway, the sedation all needs very close monitoring, very close titration, and it is all very much its own separate thing that you have to constantly keep an eye on. So this guy...
Too light, they're going to wake up.
Exactly.
You just killed him.
It's a disaster waiting to happen because...
Did someone wake up? Okay, keep going.
We're
going
to talk about it. So it's just really disturbing that he did this without an anesthesiologist or a CRNA or any sort of anesthesia provider and just took it upon himself to sedate people and hope it was enough and adequate and also hope that it didn't kill anybody because he's trying to do a procedure and also monitor all that stuff, which he really wasn't.
Right. He wasn't monitoring. He was skipping that.
Exactly. He was sort of skipping all of that. They had really no resuscitation or safety equipment there. They had no advanced airway stuff in there if anything went wrong. Like there was really nothing. I mean, if he had brought an anesthesiologist in there, they would have said, I'm not working here. Like, right, you will have to buy this, 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 and this. And that's not what he wanted. He wanted to keep it all bare bones. Yeah. So he could pocket everything. So that's sort of the type of business he was running with all of that. Right. And after Terry's brush with death, that patient with the liposuction, I had said, like I said, he had tracked her down in the hospital and when she was recovering. And he confronted her and yelled at her, essentially, for seeking medical attention, even though she was literally admitted to the hospital. Like, they admitted me because I almost died. Like, I was not wrong. You're wrong. I'm literally septic. But not even then did he think to, like, rethink things, change his practices. Like, after that outcome, he changed nothing. He just, like, doubled down. He actually, like, booked more clients. He was like, I have to like, turn over more people to hopefully get more good outcomes so that it, like, offsets the bad outcomes, right?
Did he really have any good outcomes?
He had some outcomes that weren't terrible.
Must have been on the, like, easiest procedure ever.
His
hair pieces.
He offered a number of procedures, and there were a lot of complications. We're not going to get into each and every one, but there were a lot. And it all does kind of come crashing down. So among his copious amount of new clients is 26-year-old Sarah Smith. Now, she is a former high school cheerleader who now relished home projects. She married her high school sweetheart. She had two kids under the age of 10. She was like this beautiful young woman in the prime of her life. And her family was super happy. But Sarah had undergone a nose job years prior to correct a deviated septum and get rid of like a little bump on her nose. She was like, you know, that procedure was pretty easy. Like it went pretty well. The recovery was fairly easy. And she wanted to get something else done. She had always, you know, after she had kids, she had had some changes in her body and she was really hoping to get a breast augmentation. So now the procedure comes at a cost, obviously, because the deviated septum, her insurance actually covered that because she was treating, you know, some respiratory issues, right? So they can sometimes swing that and insurance will cover it if there's actually a deviated septum, or if you have sleep apnea or something like that, they might cover a rhinoplasty. Mm-hmm. But a breast augmentation almost always is going, unless it's corrective, like for a mastectomy or trauma, that it will almost always be an out-of-pocket cost if it's a cosmetic mm-hmm. procedure. So she was looking around and pricing things out, because this time around, she's going to really have to pay for like the vast majority of it out-of-pocket. And that's how she came across Dr. Pignataro, because he's the one that's advertising all of these procedures for like really, really low cost. And that's how he brings everybody in. He says, mm-hmm. my costs are so much lower than the market average.
There's a reason.
He's a bargain. And that's why he could keep his prices so low, because he has no overhead, because he's got no help and he's not doing anything right.
Right.
So, and is too, like the oversights now that we're looking back on it are like glaring. But as a consumer, you know, you depend on laws and regulations and things. You're not supposed to be able to walk into a quote unquote established medical clinic and get a shoddy procedure by an almost not doctor and like put yourself at risk like this. And that's why we have laws and regulations. So like, while it's obvious to us, she's like, I mean, how am I supposed to, like, how am I supposed to know that I can't just, like, trust a medical setting? Like, right. How am I supposed to, as a consumer and a non-medical person, be able to assess the shortcomings of a medical facility? She can't. She has right. no place to do that. And that's how he turned out so many people, because people just don't know any better.
Well, especially, yeah, I mean, a lot of people that are, if you have desperation, lack of education.
Exactly. That's how it's so dangerous. And that's why, you know, it was allowed to go on for as long as it did, unfortunately. So she felt like he was the real deal. I mean, she went for her consultation. He, again, he's a charismatic guy. He's a good looking guy. He's successful. He's got ads all over the place. He's boasting all these great outcomes. You know, there's before and after pictures that are great. And the type of procedure that she was interested in particular was something called the transumbilical breast augmentation, or the TUBA, T-U-B-A. And they do that because with a traditional breast augmentation, they make incisions either like around the nipple or underneath the breast. Mm-hmm. But she was really hoping to not have those scars. She's like, I really like would be self-conscious if I had those scars. So the transumbilical was supposed to be a little bit less invasive. Supposedly, he had gotten trained on it and started offering it like that previous summer that she had gone. And he was like really pushing that, like as something that he was offering to like really try to, mm-hmm. you know, drum up more clients. And he was really advertising it really hard. She's like, I'd love to, you know, try that. That sounds mm-hmm. great. So what they do is they make an incision like sort of just north of the belly button, or like in the inside top part of the belly button. And the implants, when they go in, are deflated.
Right.
And they thread them up and they put them into place, mm-hmm. like subcutaneously. And once they're in position, they then inflate the right. implants.
Saline or whatever.
Exactly. With yeah. saline or whatnot. So it's just a way to like get it in there with a teeny tiny little poke. And like, if everything goes well, you walk out of it and it's like you have this tiny little poke hole right. and like new boobs. Great. You know? Sure. And
Is this an actual procedure?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It was actually coined first. Okay. No, it was coined first in 1991 by Dr. Gerald Johnson in Houston, Texas. Okay. And it's actually still performed to this
okay.
day.
So some people do it.
Yeah,
okay.
absolutely. It's actually.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's something that's still around, still successful. Absolutely.
I don't need an augmentation.
Neither
so
do I.
I've never looked into it. So I did not know.
Right. Yeah. But again, this is something that would require sedation.
Of course.
And like a team. Because this is something that takes a little bit of coordination. I mean, any surgery, really. And, you know, but Anthony is just like a businessman. You know, he just wants the highest amount of return possible. Yep. So he's cutting corners left and right. So he was hoping that once, you know, he really got it down and started offering it really like traditionally, he would be able to hike up the price. And Sarah went up and just like booked the surgery, and she was like, I'm gonna do it. I'm doing this. It's happening. So apparently, according to author Anne Rule, she goes on to explain in this book about this whole situation called Last Dance, Last Chance. Anthony didn't feel like she needed any x-rays, EKG, pre-op workup at all, really, because she was under 40 and her health history was pretty benign. So he was like, meh. He did take some lab work and do some basic tests, mm-hmm. and all those came back pretty unrevealing. So he cleared her for surgery. And typically, though, for general anesthesia, if you're going under general anesthesia, there are pre-surgical screenings. And
yeah, I got to make sure your body can tolerate it.
At a bare minimum, an EKG is probably a good idea in somebody in that age group. And sometimes also a chest X-ray, especially specifically for breast augmentation surgery, because sometimes they can catch, you know, little anatomical variations or whatnot that might interfere with the surgery since you're performing it on the chest, mm-hmm. like, yes, over the muscle wall. But that's just a thing that some people do before they perform breast augmentations. He didn't do any of that. And so it, you know, the general consensus is everybody looking back on it is that he was a little bit negligent with her pre-op workup because he really didn't order a ton of tests, really just a couple of vials of blood. He didn't do anything else. Now, on the morning of Monday, August 25th, 1997, Sarah's husband, Dan, drove her to Anthony Pignataro's office for her 9:30 a.m. appointment. And almost immediately, she was taken back and given a variety of pills meant to relax her, much like what Terry went through. She returned to the waiting room, and Dan thought that was kind of surprising that he would, like, give her a bucket of pills and then have her just sit in, like, an unmonitored setting when she had just gotten, like, some oral sedation. But the medication clearly affected his wife, and she was getting drowsier by the minute. She was, like, sitting upright in the waiting area waiting to go to the surgery center, but she was, like, falling asleep in the chair. But what happened next was pretty strange. So his wife was led behind a closed door, and Anthony insisted that Dan leave. He said, like, Dan was planning on waiting there for her to get out. And Anthony was like, no, you got to go. You should go. Which is interesting because.
Why?
When I have a procedure done, they, like, make sure that you're fucking. Ride is there if you're going under anesthesia so that, like, you don't get stuck waiting in the PACU. You know what I mean? Like, you will have a ride if you are going to have this procedure. So it's interesting that he kicked this man out. It's almost like he didn't want him to see what was going on.
Right.
So multiple times, Anthony returned and repeated himself, urging Dan to go run some errands, go get some coffee. You know, I'll call you when the procedure is done or come back in the afternoon and pick her up. And notably, Anthony did not supply Dan a time. He was not able to give him an estimate on,
like,
how long this was going to take.
2 or 3 hours.
Yeah.
Right.
He would not be able to give him that, which is odd. Like, you can't give me a ballpark. You've done this procedure how many times and you cannot estimate. I mean, I know that things happen, but, like, you can't.
2 to 3 hours.
You can't
Four
give me
six.
That. Like, that's just, it right. just seems unusual. Right. So finally Dan relented. He was like, you know, he's the doctor, he's the boss, whatever. This is his business. So he said, I'm going to head out. I'm going to return. I'm going to pick Sarah up whenever it was all over. So until then, he trusted that his wife was in good hands. So Sarah goes down to the basement surgery of the dingy West Seneca practice. The only machines that he had were an SpO2 clip, like a little SpO2 monitor, and a blood pressure cuff. That is all he had in that room for monitoring for somebody going under anesthesia.
That's not enough.
So there were no devices to keep an airway open. He did not have a ventilator. He did not have oxygen. He did not even have an oxygen tank during the procedure.
And you kind of need that stuff.
You do. I mean, if you're going to be giving conscious sedation to people, like, even if you're not putting people under general, which is where like you're fully asleep, you're sometimes paralyzed and need a ventilator to keep breathing. Even if you don't do that and you're just doing conscious sedation, you need some things to manage that. Anesthetics, if they're administered improperly, can slow or stop breathing and can lead to death. So it's pretty crucial to have monitors and equipment nearby so that you can manage that if that does happen. But Dr. Pignataro did not have any of this. He should have known this. He would have known this, but he did not care or did not bother.
Maybe that was during the part of school that he did not understand the language.
Yeah, so he was just, like, tuning out at that point, not picking it up because it was all in Spanish. Yep.
Yeah.
So, later in the morning, that August 25th, he began the procedure without any of these safeguards in place, and his concoction of drugs had put Sarah to sleep, and he hoped she'd stay that way for the next few hours while he operated. Mm-hmm. But it seemed that Sarah was more than just dozing. And during that first hour, Sarah's face began to lose color, reportedly. Noting this, Debbie Pignataro, his wife, who'd been called in to assist with this, even though she was not a medical person, made a comment to her husband that she didn't look right. She said, Anthony, look at her. She's losing her color. What is going on? But Anthony was focused. He didn't bother to even look up at her face, didn't look at her, didn't stop. He made the incision in her belly. Minutes later, he moved the tube-like device in to create a pathway to her breast to insert the implant. And Sarah's face is getting grayer and grayer and grayer by the minute. And she's like visibly not really breathing or ventilating.
Oh God.
Like visibly.
Oh.
Debbie again tries to alert her husband what's going on, and it's no use. He's just not listening. So the pulse oximeter that's on her finger starts to beep. And the oxygen levels are starting to drop, and now the beeping is happening. And according to statements later made by his 22-year-old LPN, who was also in the room at this time, Anthony then asked her to be hooked up to an EKG machine. So she goes and she gets the little heart monitor that they had in another room, wasn't even there, and the EKG showed asystole.
Uh-oh. That's not good.
So, Sarah...
You know, I mean, had he not have to hook that up, he could have already known that.
He could have already known as soon as something had started.
Yeah.
So, he had no crash cart. He had no intubation kit. He had not a single registered nurse, not anybody who could assist him in an urgent matter like this. So, Anthony told his teenage intern, the 17-year-old, to call 911. And it was the last resort, but Sarah's time was, like, running out. She was hypoxic and asystolic. So if he had had an anesthesiologist who could have been managing her airway, none of this would have happened. This was 1,000% avoidable.
100%.
Yep. So Anthony's intern calls 911. Within 5 minutes, EMS is there. When emergency teams entered the basement.
Oh, shit. They know that that's not the right environment for her to be.
They could not believe what they were seeing, because what they saw was Anthony Pignataro attempting to create an airway by sticking a yellow coat hanger down her throat.
No.
To open up her trachea. He had a coat hanger.
No.
In his hand.
A yellow one.
A coat hanger. I don't know what his goal was. I'm so floored by this because I'm like, what even was this that you were trying to do? I don't know
Hello,
what they
sir,
said.
Please stop.
Can you please remove that very yellow coat hanger from this?
I hope it wasn't metal. Because they'll perforate the trachea.
No, it was wire.
One.
It was wire. It was wire. Yeah. A yellow wire coat hanger. So Anthony reportedly... later said that he was terrified and reflexively tried to keep Sarah's airway open in this very bizarre and dangerous way because he had no equipment and no other method to resuscitate her, and he had no competent staff. There was no ACLS anywhere. And somehow he picked up a wire coat hanger and was like, yes, I will use
this. Last stitch ever.
This is what I'm going to do right now. Even if somehow he did... open an airway.
This is absurd.
It sounds made up. I'm going to say it again. It sounds fucking made up. This is insane. And even if he had gotten it in there and like threaded that thing, like how is that delivering more oxygen to her brain? That's what I want to know.
You're not doing nothing.
You're doing nothing. So like we all know this. We listen to this and know how absurd it is. But like this actually happened.
So she clearly did not survive.
So
did they get her in
stay
time?
Stay tuned.
I must know.
He was intercepted by the paramedics. Anthony starts yelling directions at them. He screamed, reportedly, we can't lose this one.
No shit.
So they're panicking, of course. Anthony, even when he's panicking, he can't pass up a moment to feel superior.
Right.
So medics, of course, initially assess her, start CPR. They shock her and they get ROSC. They get a rhythm back. They send her to the hospital. But, I mean, a lot of damage had been done. She had suffered 19 or 20 minutes.
You don't know really
of no
how
oxygen.
Long because he didn't. He
we don't
then hooked
for sure.
Up the machine.
We only know by estimations because there was nothing else hooked
being
up.
Monitored.
Thank God EMS got there when they did and did what they did. So at the time, you know, they were thinking, wow, it will be like a miracle if she emerged from this without a serious brain injury.
For sure.
So in the ER later that day, Sarah slipped into a coma. Hours later at 2:30 p.m., Sarah's husband, Dan, had yet to learn any of this.
No.
Nobody had even called him and told him, hey, something went horribly wrong with
Which
your wife's
would have been
procedure.
Job,
right.
Like,
yeah. Oh, God. And you think he was ever going to
no.
fuck that. So he pulls into the parking lot at the practice and Sarah's not even there. EMS has already taken
her.
So he enters the office and Dan was surprised to find that Debbie Pignataro was at the desk and she broke the news to him. And of course, Dan did not receive it well at all and was like, what the fuck am I learning about this now?
Yeah.
And why am I not at the hospital where my wife is? Mm-hmm. And what have you done?
Mm-hmm.
So he goes to the hospital and he sees, you know, the mother of his two children, essentially comatose. And he, you know, like sort of grapples with this bomb that has just been dropped, you know, upon him and his entire existence. And the team that found her in that state, the EMS personnel that resuscitated her, contacted the Seneca Police Department.
Good.
Because they were
thank gosh.
I don't know what the fuck this was, but that's not medicine.
Right.
That is a horror show.
Some kind of backwards,
I don't know,
shit.
When I tell you this whole thing that this happened so not long ago is mind boggling.
So not long ago.
This is not that long ago. So, I mean, what they had said, what EMS had said, when they walked in, first of all, they were like, this is a basement.
Get the coat hanger out of her mouth.
And they noticed that there was no crash cart. They noticed that there was no anesthesiologist. They noticed that there was barely any staff and that everything was unsanitary and disgusting and that he didn't even have the right tools for the procedure that he was doing. So, I mean, they were this guy is a monster. I don't know what's going on, but he's a monster.
Mm-hmm.
So following that, Anthony's response was to kick it into overdrive and book even more surgeries because he was really nervous that his license was soon going to be revoked. And so he ignored all of the glaring safety issues and these terrible outcomes. And he just was hoping to turn a lot more profit while he could because he's an absolute shitbag.
Roll it in before it stops.
Yep, before it stops. So on August 29th, 1997, he faced his first brush with reality of the situation, and two officers knocked on the door of his practice. They wanted his official account of the events, and they wanted all of the medical records that he had. So Anthony's first response was that, actually, my attorney has advised me not to talk to you.
Bullshit.
So he was just like, immediately, I'm unhelpful. Immediately, no. What he had said once his attorney was there to investigators was that he had sedated Sarah Smith with a local anesthetic and oral medications that would make it so she would sort of like drift in and out of consciousness before he started the surgery, and got concerned when the pulse oximeter rang out. Perhaps she had taken something else before coming to his office, which, like, victim blaming, really?
Right.
Dude, come on, give me a fucking break. But he said, well, I don't know about that, but maybe she took something. I don't know. Anyway, did not sit right with investigators. They did not buy it. Definitely didn't buy it. They had a lot of questions. Unfortunately, Anthony's lawyer made it really hard for them to get anywhere because he was being really argumentative. And when they had more questions after he gave his statement, he kind of just like stood up and was like, no, I'm done with this discussion. And he excused himself. And unfortunately, they couldn't argue because they had nothing to hold him on as of yet. So they still had to kind of piece together what happened and like just based on, you know, statements by other staff, his statements and what the patient and her husband had seen while they were there. So Monday, September 1st in 97, Dan decided to pull the plug on his wife after she made really no promising recovery, which is so sad. He was told by providers, unfortunately, that in her current state, because she had really shown no improvement, it was very likely that she would remain in a persistent vegetative state. And that there was really not much hope of any meaningful brain recovery. Mm-hmm. So she was 26 years old.
Oh, my God.
26.
Oh, that's awful.
So that is something that investigators saw. And they're like, this might actually be a homicide. This could be a homicide.
Yeah.
So this escalates it from a local police matter to a, like, the DA is now aware. Okay. Like, we're getting involvement from, like, a more state and
you
federal.
You really now do need to get your attorney involved, Mr.
Exactly.
Anthony.
Like, let's get this figured out. So Pat Finity and Chuck Craven are two lead detectives for the DA's office in West Seneca, New York, and they were put as the lead detectives on this case. And they did not waste any time locating any eyewitnesses. First, they go for the doctor's wife, because she was literally there in the room and she lives with the guy. So she's pretty torn up. Debbie is 39 years old at this point. She's describing her. She's been very cooperative, by the way. And she's describing her struggle trying to get through to her husband that morning as Sarah's face was turning grayer and grayer. And I mean, she isn't even a medical person and she knows something
Where
is very wrong.
He
she was in the room.
In the,
she was in the room. She was. It was. trying to do what she was being told to, I think. And, wow. You know, he's just steamrolling everybody is the issue. Now, the teen intern, when it was her turn to sort of give like a little bit of a statement, she kind of explained that basically she was a gopher for Anthony. Anything he needed, like, she just like went and got it for him. She did a lot of errands. She did a lot of clerical stuff. She didn't do anything medical, really. But she gave statements, too, about, you know, the patient and the husband and like the interactions that they had. All of that was helpful, and it kind of propelled the investigation. Now, the statements from the 22-year-old nurse who had been at the scene was also very helpful. Right. And while Pat and Chuck, the detectives, noted that she seemed like a bit reluctant to talk, it also seemed like she was, even though she was an LPN and even though she had worked in this surgery center, she had really no knowledge about very basic medical stuff. Like, she didn't know what an ambu bag was. She didn't know what a scalpel was. She was having trouble recalling, like, really basic details. And it struck them as really odd because, I mean, I've never met a nurse that doesn't know what an ambu bag and a scalpel is.
Right.
I mean, that just seems bizarre. Like, very bizarre. And on the day of Sarah's surgery, Dr. Anthony Pignataro had given Sarah 20 milligrams of Valium, which is a high fucking dose. That's a lot of Valium. And then he directed his nurse to administer 6 cubic centimeters of sodium pentothal and 6 cubic centimeters of the narcotic Versed, which is a sedative. Mm-hmm. We've talked about that before. Combining all of these, especially when there's no airway support, no oxygen, and no plan, is exceedingly dangerous. I mean, these are pretty fucking high doses. I mean, if you're in an OR and there's a provider literally watching you breathe and measuring your hemodynamics every second, sure. Huh? Like, sure. You can give medicines to support the hemodynamics and keep you asleep and comfortable. But he didn't have any of that. This was like lethal in his hands because he had no safeguards whatsoever. So before the surgery began, Anthony directed his nurse, the LPN, to administer a second dose of sodium pentothal through the IV port. Minutes later, as he made an incision, Sarah, the patient, was noted to have said, ouch. So she felt something. So Anthony's response was to tell his nurse to give a third dose of sodium pentothal. So even to Pat and Chuck, who weren't versed in medicine, they were like, that seems like a lot of fucking substances on for somebody with no oxygen, no monitors, nothing. That's exactly a lot of chemicals in somebody.
Keep going, more.
That's insane. So, and Sarah was a very, very petite girl. She was like 100 pounds soaking wet. Like, in terms of body weight, like, metabolizing all of these drugs. Like, she's getting extreme high doses for somebody of her size. And they did do toxicology testing when she went into the hospital to figure out exactly what she had on board in her system. And the toxicology came back a few weeks after the fact. It did confirm their suspicions that an excessive amount of sodium pentothal and other substances had caused asphyxiation. And Sarah's death was a direct result of the drugs that Anthony Pignataro had mandated during his procedure, as well as his failure to ventilate her properly.
So now this makes it the homicide case.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So the press gets a hold of this and they fucking run. They take right off
I
for
bet.
It. Other patients who had bad outcomes from Pignataro started coming forward and talking to police directly and talking to the media about their experiences. People waking up with hundreds of staples across their stomach. Somebody had a sponge, like a gauze sponge left inside them, which is like a sentinel event. I mean, if that happens, it does happen. Weirdly enough, it does happen. But if that happens in a hospital, that's a fucking huge investigation and a really big deal. Somebody had that happen. Somebody had a chemical peel that went really bad and they were left permanently scarred and with chronic pain. Like, horrible, horrible things. And by winter 1997, 13 women besides Sarah had allegations against Anthony. 13 separate terrible outcomes. Among them was Terry Lamotti, who was that patient with the perforation. Yep. And with all of that together, all of these testimonies, that was enough for the DA to secure a search warrant. And while Anthony wasn't at his practice one day, investigators walked in and they started pouring through everything, seizing everything, searching everything.
Checking out that basement.
Yeah, checking out the basement. Like many patients before, they went down into the basement and found a makeshift surgery center, a single chair that sat in the center with a fucking creepy ass light hanging over it to help him see during these botchy operations.
This is giving me like these asylum vibes.
Well, that's what
you know what I mean?
Like, I know. It's like, are we at Penthurst Asylum?
Right,
like,
is right.
That's what it seems like. It seems like a medieval fucking situation down there. There were, like, very few items that were, like, connected to wires or, like, plugged in or, like, even electronics down there. It was like a hole. It was like a hole in the ground. There was, like, very little sterilization equipment.
Looks better than that.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. We're very organized down here. We can just put a chair over there and start performing surgeries and probably have better outcomes.
Done.
Yeah. One might expect to find a similar setup at like a stage performance of like a horror show, like you said. Like literally this was it reminds me of like an asylum or like a haunted house. Like you're in a haunted house and right. It's like you're walking through and oh my god, like a creepy like that's what this is like. It's like a haunted house. Huge red flags. So along the walls of Anthony's office, there were all these diplomas, right? And like we know how much graduating he did. With all of his education.
You sure do.
Not that much. Okay. So Pat and Chuck are looking at all these, the detectives, and they're like, I think maybe we should check up on this. So they make a bunch of calls to all of these institutions that he has diplomas. Not a one say that he actually graduated from their programs, from their residencies, from their fellowships. They're all fucking fake.
Yeah.
Smoke and mirrors.
Yep.
So his little facade is starting to crumble.
Yep.
Thankfully.
Coming down.
Not only had this guy now killed an innocent woman and also his practice before had resulted in deaths, right. That guy who died from endocarditis, that was easily that all of these people are like permanently maimed and scarred and injured from their encounters with him. He had screwed up on all of these patients and he can't even just like be honest about his certifications or lack thereof. I mean, the guy is just a complete back alley asshole, as you know what I mean? So. January 27th, 1998, Anthony was indicted before a grand jury on 6 counts: manslaughter in the second degree, assault in the second degree, falsifying business records in the first degree, reckless endangerment in the second degree, criminal possession of a forged instrument in the third degree, and criminally negligent homicide.
Oh, that is a list.
Yes, it is. Not enough, in my opinion,
no,
but here
of course,
we are.
But that is like a good, aggressive
hey,
list.
Hey, man,
like,
it is.
We mean business.
I feel like they got that together quick, too, like in half a year. Mm-hmm. That's not bad with everything they had to go through. Anthony really wanted to fight for his innocence, but his attorneys told him that going to trial would likely be prison time. He's like, you're not getting out of this. Like, there's a lot against you here. This is not looking good. They urged him to plead guilty. So with his name on the line, Anthony wavered. He was like, I don't want to admit that I did anything wrong because I'm fucking Anthony Pignataro.
And he's been the pompous ass this whole time.
And
like,
he's going to
admit my wrongdoing.
He's going to be a pompous ass forever. Throughout the spring of 1998, 39-year-old Anthony Pignataro faced that tough decision on what he's, you know, willing to own up to and not. Either accept a plea deal or go to trial on major charges, and including the criminally negligent homicide, which would be devastating
right.
for him. So on June 8th, 1998, he made up his mind. He pleaded guilty.
Wow.
And he waived any right to appeal
first time
his
in
sentence.
His life he's taken any kind of ownership.
But he only did it to save his hide.
Of course.
Like, yeah, that's the like only reason he did it, to get out of, you know, whatever trouble he was in. So he pleaded guilty, and also what he would have to do is give up his medical license.
That's it?
Mm-hmm.
Did he get prison time?
It wasn't a huge sacrifice, obviously, because most of his credentials were fake
right.
anyway and exaggerated. So on August 4th, he was sentenced to 6 months in jail, 5 years probation, 250 community service hours, and a $2,500 fine.
That's not enough.
No, he killed a woman.
6 months in jail.
He killed a woman.
Wow.
He killed a woman.
And with all of the other stuff that's in, like, wow, plead guilty or not. Like, I know you get reduced sentences when you plead guilty, but that's not enough.
No, it's fucking shitty.
Yeah.
It's really shitty.
Wow.
And it gets shittier. We're not done.
It does?
With this. Oh, yeah.
What?
We are not done.
Oh, my God.
Somehow, Anthony, through all of this, had retained Debbie's loyalty, and she stuck by him. Because she had kids with him and she did, and she, you know, he's a fucking manipulative asshole.
Yeah.
She probably should have said goodbye a long ass time ago. She really should have.
Yeah.
She should not have stood by him as long as she did. But she did. She still believed he was a good guy all the way down. She's like, I've been with this guy for 20 years. You know, I know him at his core. I still really hope and pray that he's the guy that I met
Debbie.
20 years ago. So her trust was, unfortunately, very misplaced, because she's now the wife of a convicted felon. So she thought, you know, maybe a little jail time will be like a turning point for us. You know what I mean? Like maybe this will be like a huge turning point. He's really going to turn things around. He's going to start a new life. We're okay financially right now. And when 40-year-old Anthony was released from prison, Debbie had hope that this could be like a new beginning for them. Maybe this could be an excuse to be like a new beginning. So,
or not.
I know. Now, their kids are like in junior high school, and his son plays football. His daughter is in gymnastics. He attended a lot of their competitions and he brought them places. And he did initially appear to be like a lot more invested in his family. And everybody around him is like, you know, really hoping that he's kind of turning a new leaf. He did his community service hours. He completed all of those. He even volunteered at a therapeutic horse riding center for people from underrepresented backgrounds and individuals with disabilities to like help them learn like new skills and like that. I mean, she was really hoping that this would be like a turning point for him.
So what went wrong?
So it was just another act, or at least it was just, you know, very short lived, whatever it was. Debbie gets a letter just about a week after he returned from jail. And in it, there was news that Anthony had been having an affair from jail.
Shit.
The relationship had started before he went to jail and was still happening. And this was not the first time that Anthony had cheated. We talked about that in part one. In the past, Debbie had forgiven him, but she was not sure if she could do the same thing.
She was like, you have one chance.
Yep. She said, you get one of those. And now it's happening again. So she kind of held her tongue for a while. She bided her time. She wanted to really think about how she was going to respond to this because there's a lot of moving parts here. There's a lot going on in her life. She wanted her children to continue living the lives that they knew. She didn't want to have to split up her family. Her kids are in junior high. That's a really sensitive time to have to put kids through a divorce. So she's having to consider all of these bits and pieces before she divorces this guy. So on the other hand, Anthony's behavior had once again totally shattered her trust, you know? So, but he's like going through this and he's saying, I'm a changed man, you know? She confronts him and he's like, really, like this, I'm a changed man. Like I'm doing these hours. I did my jail time. I don't want to keep having that affair. I'm with you. And he is just like really laying it on thick. So she's pouring over her options. Debbie's wondering if, you know, are there other things you're hiding from me? Like, is this just you're telling me because I found out? Like, I mean, I don't think I probably would have ever found out about it if somebody didn't send me a letter. And she starts going through their bank statements, and she soon finds that Anthony is making regular $100 mystery withdrawals from their bank account. And desperate for answers, Debbie does a little bit more digging and finds Anthony's mistress's home address.
Oh.
And so he's still sending her money, even though he's like, I'm a changed man. I don't want to keep doing this. He's still clearly having a relationship with this woman. So one day in February of 99, she decides to pay a visit to this lady. But when she pulls up, she finds that the family Cadillac is parked in their driveway.
Oh, so he's there.
So he's there.
Oh, busted.
So Debbie drives the car home, leaving her van for Anthony to find whenever he decides to come out of the house. Because she a petty bitch, and that's fantastic. Fucking stan that move. I thought it was so funny.
I love that move. Yep. I would have loved to knock
on the
door.
You take the van, motherfucker.
I would have loved to knock on the door.
Oh, yeah.
The van to just come out and see your caddy gone.
Yep. I would have loved to see that fucking face,
that's
dude.
Good. That's a good one.
But that evening, Anthony decided to not come home.
Of course not, because he's been busted.
He calls his wife and he tries to tell her it wasn't what it looked like. But Debbie was like, fuck you, bro. So Anthony had pushed her too far. She had all the locks changed on the house to ensure that he couldn't come back unless he demonstrated a willingness to change. She also withdrew all the money from their joint account. She said, fuck you. You're done. I am done with this. So even worse, Anthony's mom found out about his affair and threatened to cut him off from his dad's estate if he left Debbie. So that's a problem because he's kind of backed into a corner at this point.
Yep.
So Anthony doesn't like the sound of that. So he did what he always does in a pinch, which is fucking figure out a stupid plan, a stupid scheme.
Hey, Kate, guess what?
What?
I am super comfortable right now.
Same.
Oh, you want to know why?
Yep, I do.
Because I'm in my comfort clothes.
Oh my God, me too. I love comfort. Ah!
The holidays are right around the corner.
Literally five.
Like 5 minutes away.
Like I hear that little Mariah Carey. Hi.
She's unthawing. It's that time of year. We're all looking to restock on some winter cool weather stuff.
Yep.
Don't forget to beef up your cozy weather wardrobe too.
Yeah, buddy. If you're like me and you're in your cozy girl era, because that is where I live. Comfort is nice because it has options for the whole family. They have men's clothes, they have women's clothes, they have kids, and even furry friends.
The dog! You know, ever since you told me about Comfort and I've been exploring in it, I never want to get out of these clothes.
I wash all of my Comfort stuff on constant rotation because I get pissed if I have to sleep in anything else or wear a different sweatshirt.
My favorite part is that they're very size inclusive.
Their matching sets come in this variety of weights, the variety of colors. Every single thing that I have gotten has been so high quality.
I love the colors.
Oh,
me too. I'm currently in a mix of the dark, warm green fall color mm-hmm. with some light blue pastel.
Like, yes.
I am a season mix right now.
You literally are. I am in the Comfort Pastel Edit, the light pink color in the crew neck sweatshirt, and it is one of my favorites. I wear it all the time. And it's hard to describe, but I have a lot of sweatshirts, okay? Don't at me. But since I've been wearing Comfort, I always reach for these first. Because they're so soft, they're so comfortable, but they have enough structure that it feels like you're getting a warm hug when you put it on. You know what I mean?
Who doesn't like warm hugs?
Olaf likes warm hugs, and so do I.
As hell does. But I'm really thinking about getting the Comfort weighted blanket.
Oh my God, I know. We gotta get some from the Pod Lab, dude.
So not only do they have the clothes, but they have the luxurious blanket as well.
They really do.
And I don't know about any of you, but I love a good weighted blanket.
My next one is gonna be the Travel Essentials hoodie because it has a built-in eye mask. And like, what? You heard me right. There is a built-in eye mask on this bad boy. They have all of the colors. The quality is so high, and it holds up really well over time. I've washed these things, like I said, on constant rotation.
That's my favorite. I hate when my favorite stuff starts to pill.
Yes. These don't do that. Nope. These do not do that. They're so functional. They are loaded with pockets, which I love. I got to have a pocket. You know what I mean? So everything is like not only so comfortable, but so functional. You know,
absolutely.
And makes things so easy. And the prices are honestly super affordable. And they're actually having a sale right now. So, yep, GTFO. Get over there.
Get over there.
Get over there.
So if you want to check out and get your own Comfort stuff right before the holiday season, check out www.comfort, that's comfort.com/medcrimes and get 15% off your purchase.
That is www.comfort.com, comfort.com/medcrimes for 15% off of your purchase.
Go and get snuggly.
Woo!
Do it.
So for several months, he stays away from his family home. And Debbie is desperate to know what he's up to, but she's like, I'm not even going to engage. He's doing something. I know he's up to something, but I'm not even going to engage. Still, he visited at random in March of that year. And in April, he started coming by more regularly.
I'm so intrigued.
You know, I think, and he starts like really kind of laying it on thick and playing into all those things
bullshit.
That she really liked. Oh, yeah. She's like starting to kind of like fall victim to this again.
No, Debbie!
I know. The other thing was, he told her, I'd like to start working again, too, in the medical field. And if I start looking outside the state, I can do that, too, because this was all a DA level case. And they will not know if in the next state over, I get a job in the medical field.
Oh, come on.
That my license has been revoked. I can get a reciprocity license through a different state.
That doesn't fly now.
No, it does not. No, there's too much crap going on. So Debbie somehow kept the secret. She respected his wishes.
Debbie.
I know.
Debbie.
She's really thinking he really wants to clean up his act this time
Debbie,
and do things right.
I can't. Anymore, honey.
He goes for some interviews. He doesn't get the job. Still, she starts feeling safer having Anthony living at the house because their house starts to get vandalized regularly. So somebody had been writing killer on their front door, slashing their tires, breaking their windows, and she starts feeling uncomfortable just being by herself with the kids in the house. So she doesn't start inviting Anthony to come, like, stay back in the house. But in all likelihood, it comes out later, he's the one probably vandalizing the house.
Really?
Yes.
Trying to make it like...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, exactly.
I hate this guy.
And it had the intended effect. He was being very manipulative. This guy is fucking... He's not... He's a lot of things, but he knows people and what makes them tick. It's very scary. It's very scary. So she starts getting more lenient and he starts spending the night regularly and he eventually starts like really staying at the house. And it was around this time that Debbie started feeling ill. She started having excruciating stomach pains, and she started visiting her doctor regularly. And they suspected maybe it was pancreatitis, but they couldn't really be sure. Ultimately, Debbie was sent home from the hospital with more questions than answers. She never really had a straight answer as to what was going on, but she started sort of just like continuously feeling ill. Never really felt great.
No.
The summer comes and the heat just kind of makes everything worse.
He did.
Hold on, Devin. You hold your bite your tongue, young lady. You bite it. Clamp on it. She starts getting numbness and tingling around her body.
I hate him.
She starts finding it harder to remember things. She starts having all of these other very concerning symptoms. Some days she can't even make it out of bed because she's so in crippling agony. Now, when that happened, her husband would bring her food, but she endorsed that it never really tasted right. And it all sort of had this little Devin so fucking pissed right now. It all sort of had the same little undertaste to it. So this metallic flavor tainted almost everything she ate. And she was thinking that it was a symptom of her illness. She said, everything tastes like metal to me. She starts growing weaker and weaker. And her doctor, she's getting referrals, she's seeing neurologists, she's getting imaging, she's getting testing. Nobody can fucking figure it out. But in August of that year, her condition takes a turn for the worst. And one doctor starts wondering if Debbie had been poisoned. Yep. Now, Debbie immediately dismissed the theory. She's
come
like,
on.
You can test my blood. Not. She's like, seriously, test my blood. I would love to see you test my blood. There's no way I'm fucking being poisoned. The results came back. And they did a 24-hour urine test, and it detected 29,580 micrograms of arsenic per liter in her system.
I was almost...
So most people who ingest, like, regular dietary amounts of arsenic that are just, like, present in nuts and fruit and, like, stuff like that, have between, like, 5 and 20 micrograms per liter. And that's only if you've eaten some recently.
And you said how much did she have?
29,580 micrograms.
Wow. So that's... She's been poisoned.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Given the results of her urinalysis, it was a miracle she was alive. Literally a miracle. Ingesting arsenic in small amounts over time produces all of the symptoms that Debbie was experiencing and can actually, you know, people can survive consistent exposures, but unfortunately, it can create more lasting effects if you're poisoned over a more long period of time. And these symptoms can be vague and consistent with a myriad of other illnesses. So it can be really, really difficult to diagnose. And that just like prolongs, you know, the exposure, unfortunately. But after that result, there was really no question about it. Debbie had been poisoned. The who would be a tougher question, but I mean, for all of us, it's obvious who it was.
Are we sure it's a tough question?
It's not tough for us.
Was it tough for Debbie? Debbie
has really been in denial for a long-ass time, okay? Debbie is a very wounded lady, I think, on a lot of levels. It's really sad that she sort of allowed this. I shouldn't say allowed, because she was manipulated and this guy was an asshole. There were things that she ignored and that she went along with. I think that she probably, in hindsight, should have said no. And that's the thing.
You know? I get it.
Yep, we get it. Absolutely.
But please tell me she finally came to her turning point.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Okay. So Chuck Craven and Pat Finity, the DA's office investigators who had run Anthony's investigation, on August 26, got permission to search her home and took a lock of her hair. And the strand of hair revealed that Debbie's poisoning seemed to begin in June, right around the time Anthony had moved back in with his family.
Hmm. Around the time she started feeling ill.
Yeah, exactly. So they flagged that as suspicious. And even that timeline was enough for them to be like, it's fucking this guy. It's got to be. But they needed a motive. They needed to really prove that he had access to that. They needed to do some digging. After they did a little bit more digging, they learned about Anthony's latest affair and what a mess it had been. And they found out that Anthony's mother had told him that he'd lose his inheritance if he had divorced Debbie. And next they learned that Debbie had a $100,000 life insurance policy and that her husband was a beneficiary. And that was only recently set up. So as far as new beginnings with his mistress were concerned, it made a lot more sense for Anthony to kill Debbie than to leave her. It wasn't until an unexpected witness found them that Chuck and Pat were able to confirm their theory. This is a man who we're going to call Adam, and he had come forward saying that he spent some time in jail with Anthony, and Anthony had told him some shit. So around that time...
You got to be careful with your jail buddies.
Oh, yeah. Around that time, Anthony had actually started doing heroin, and after both of them got released, and they still met up sometimes, these two buddies from jail, And Adam remembered Anthony bringing up the subject of poison and how annoyed his wife was making him and how he constantly was feeling that she was checking on him, nagging him to do things, do this, do that, and that essentially her presence was very inconvenient for him. He'd even said that Debbie had to go, quote unquote. Said, Debbie's got to go. Adam knew what that meant. He knew what he was inferring. Like, it was clear that he was inferring something by that. But he didn't think that Anthony was capable of murdering his own wife. But when the news came out about Debbie's poisoning, he was like, hi, I'd like to raise my hand, please. I suspect that Anthony did this. And let me tell you what he said. And that really helped the prosecution. That really helped the whole investigation. So at the start of September of that year, they also got a hold of Anthony's mistress, who started talking too, and she starts telling a similar story. Meanwhile, Debbie had tried her very best to remain loyal to this man this whole entire time, and he just fucking poisoned her. This guy's the fucking worst. She had a really hard time wrapping her head around the idea that he had done this. Even after the investigation was starting to point that way,
I think it's really... because, like, finally, when it's finally in front of your face and with no deniability, you know what I mean? Like,
There's no way around it.
There's no way to, like, try to convince yourself that it's not is what it is.
Exactly. Know? It's just, she's just doing everything she can to try to try to get that back for herself, which is so sad. Finally, it seemed like her unshakable devotion was, like, starting to wane a little bit, and she realized, I've got to let this guy go. He needs to be out of my life. There's just no way. So throughout that fall, Debbie remained in the hospital. She was undergoing extensive physical rehab. She had to go to a skilled nursing facility to regain strength. She has persistent numbness in her limbs and memory issues as a result of this. And although the majority of Debbie's symptoms were starting to abate a little bit, that numbness, the memory issues, the intestinal symptoms, all, you know, sort of like persisted. And she has, like, chronic illnesses because of this, which is so sad. As a result of arsenic's ability to cause cellular death in the body's peripheral nerves, it's very likely that all of that nerve damage is going to be permanent and it's never going to recover.
Wow.
So she spent a lot of days and a lot of time trying to regain mobility in her body. And she finally had the time at that point to consider, like, how am I going to move forward? Like, you know, it's not going to be hard to get Anthony charged with her poisoning because there's a lot of evidence against him. And the DA investigators are all over her and they're showing her all of this evidence. And, like, she's, like, pretty on board with all of that, as well as all the witness statements. So Anthony had also broken two major probation provisions. So that was going to be easier to get him behind bars at the very least, because he was still exactly
what
because
was it that he broke.
So he had to stay drug free, which he was not. He was doing heroin, according to drug tests, you know, after the fact. And he couldn't leave the county and he had gone out of the state to interview for jobs. So that was enough. So in the months following his release from jail, Anthony had been drinking tequila daily. He had been admitting that he had been using heroin and he had left the state. So in February 1st of 2000, 41-year-old Anthony was arrested. A month later, he was sentenced to 4 years for violating his probation. And a year later, in February of 2001, he was sentenced to the maximum prison term of 15 years for attempting to poison his wife.
Thank God.
Thank goodness.
So he's finally behind for some time.
Yes, for, like, an actual chunk of time. So Anthony did try to keep contact with his son while he was locked up, but the damage had already been done. His son was like, he did write one letter to his dad and he was like, I'm just asking that you do right by your family one time and never
leave
fucking contact us again. So he sent him that letter. And in December of 2013, Anthony was released from his sentence early and followed his goal of moving to Florida. And apparently he settled in the Palm Beach area and changed his name to Anthony Hoat. Despite his multiple brushes with the law, it seems that the back alley doctor himself still lives on, and he most recently resurfaced on an elderly care ad in 2019.
No. What?
Where he received necessary training for that role remains a fucking huge question, because what?
I gotta go find this ad.
I know!
I gotta go find this ad.
As for all of the people he harmed in this insane debacle, his many victims, you know, a lot of them have lasting damage, lasting scarring. And, you know,
were they ever able to bring past charges to the other people that came forward? Like,
I'm not sure. I don't think so.
You know what I mean? Because, like, so many women came forward, like, because they found that his license was fake, all of that stuff, and he performed those procedures.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have been homicide, but it would have been assault.
No, but it would have, and I think that they used it to sort of bolster that initial conviction, even though he only got such a shit. I mean, it wasn't, and it wasn't even that it went to trial because he pled down.
Yeah.
Which sucks, but, you know, it just sucks that there was really no justice for them.
And so the last 12 years, he's just been living life in Florida?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Where he remains. So if you run into a guy caring for your mother or father named Anthony Hote, maybe move your mom or dad or...
Oh, God, I hate that guy.
Is he not the fucking
worst? I don't think
I've
ever been so mad at someone like this in a long
time. You threw your microphone.
I threw my microphone.
She threw her microphone.
And I'm hearing her symptoms and God damn it, I'm like, fucking arsenic. I'm like, what would it be?
You are absolutely right on the money. You got it. You've done this long enough now.
I've done it long enough.
You're graduating from Med Crimes College.
As soon as you said she's not feeling well, I'm like, here we go.
Here we go. It's arsenic. Oh. Isn't that crazy? That surprise element in there where he tries to fucking kill his wife. I just... People be people in, man. In every industry.
People be better people in. Come on.
You know what? We got to do better as a human race.
We need to be better people in.
You know what? If you're out here and you're up to some of that fuck shit, you can change.
Be a better people.
Be a better people.
Thank you for listening, everyone.
Yes, thank you kindly.
You can search for us at on Facebook, Med Crimes Podcast.
You can find us on YouTube by searching Med Crimes Podcast.
You can check us out on Instagram at, guess what? Med Crimes Podcast.
And if you wish to become a Patreon, you can find us at www.patreon.com/medcrimespodcast.
You can please send us any crazy stories, ideas, or suggestions to be part of our next Break Room Banter
in
2 weeks.
Boom!
Season 4 is coming to an end. Crimes@gmail.com.
Stay safe out there.
Toodaloo.
Bye.